Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How have the legacies of colonialism and Cold War militarism combined with changing economic policies and the emerging ravages of climate change to form a sort of perfect storm of devastation in the vulnerable countries that lie to the near north and south of the equator? And could the planned responses by the nations of the developed world make the situation worse? Christian Parenti is a contributing editor at The Nation and a visiting scholar at City University of New York. He combined both historic scholarship and active on-the-ground reporting to come to the conclusions laid out in his new book, The Tropic of Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Christian, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So you define the Tropic of Chaos as the space between the Tropic of Cancer to the north and the Tropic of Capricorn to the south. Talk first about how physical landscapes have changed there.
Well, the main thing is there's creeping desertification in that region, and punctuated by extreme, the drought is punctuated by flooding. So you see that pattern again and again in East Africa, where I opened the book, across northeast Brazil. So a similar pattern, and that's, you know, one way that the landscape is changing. You know, there's increased urbanization, too, as a result of both economic and military policies and climate change kicking in.
And in some places where people have been able to count for thousands of years on regular monsoons, those no longer are so regular.
That's right. Mm-hmm. The intertropical convergence zone is a weather system that governs rains in a lot of the tropics, and it's a belt of precipitation that is pulled north and south between the Tropic of Cancer and Tropic of Capricorn by the sun when the sun is overhead. And that's in many places like East Africa, people have been able to count on the arrival of the rains with the intertropical convergence zone passing over and then passing back. And so there's frequently two rainy seasons in a lot of areas on the tropics. But so that weather system, for example, is out of whack. The monsoons, yes, they frequently will fail or come in a really insane deluge, as happened last year in Pakistan, and is actually happening again. It seems there's more flooding in Pakistan again. But so, yeah, the weather systems upon which people who are live close to the land as farmers and fishermen, the weather systems they depend on are being disrupted. And scientists are very clear that you can't really blame any specific weather event or climatological event on climate change. But what you can say is that there is a pattern that has been predicted by climate scientists, and it is unfolding as they predicted, except faster than they predicted. And it, you know, it is simply that in burning fossil fuels and loading the atmosphere with CO2 traps more heat from the sun. As the planet's temperature increases, there is increased desertification, drought, extreme weather, the disruption of these basic weather patterns, and that's happening, and it's happening sooner than was predicted. And so the broad pattern definitely is caused by climate change. Now, if any little event within the climate change, are these hurricanes, those tornadoes, that freak snowstorm caused by climate change definitively? No, you can't argue with that level of specificity.
Yeah.
But this pattern is unfolding of extreme weather, which is leading to drought and around much of the planet. And as we can see in the Horn of Africa, you know, bad drought plus bad policy can equal famine, can equal mass migration, warfare.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because most people, if they think about deaths attributed to climate change, they think about a severe weather event affecting someone's personal safety. You open your book with a description of the death of a Kenyan cattleman. He was murdered, but your sense really is that climate change was a major catalyst in the violence that killed him.
Yes. I mean, I never argue that climate change is the sole cause of anything, but I look at how it exacerbates situations. Mm-hmm. So in that case, there's this guy named Ekuru Lorimon who has been killed the day before in a cattle raid in the Turkana region of northwest Kenya. And I ask, why did he die? And at one level, you could say, well, you know, one of his neighbors from the Pokot tribe killed him. But dig deeper historically, and there's a number of things going on. There is the fact that there's this drought that's been, in the last 10 years, they've had a series of three major droughts punctuated by very, very inadequate rainy seasons. So it's almost like one long decade drought. And that has forced the pastoralists, the Turkana are nomadic and semi-nomadic pastoralists, the browse, the grasslands and brush that the cattle graze on is all dried up, and you know the acacia trees look like driftwood, and so the cattle are getting sick and dying, so the Turkana are clustering around what few water holes there are where they can water their cattle and where there's a little bit more vegetation, and that makes them susceptible to raiding, and people are raiding each other more and more. But then also, you know, why are there not more water holes? Why is there not programs of introducing different livestock and helping the Turkana adjust? Part of the answer is the Kenyan government's embrace of radical free market economics over the last 20, 30 years, which has held that government plays no good role in the economy and is only a distortion upon the market and therefore should be rolled up and removed from economic activity. And so as a result, there's much less extension of veterinary services or programs for water harvesting to capture the rain and store it when it does fall, because it does fall there, but you know, in freak flooding events frequently. Or introducing, you know, camels. That was something people were talking about, how there needs to be a switch away from goats and sheep and cattle to camels that can deal with this arid climate. So the state isn't there doing those kinds of things because the prevailing economic theory being pushed by the World Bank and the IMF over the last 30 years, particularly on developing indebted countries like Kenya, is that the government should remove itself from the economy, and so it has. And so people like Ekuru Aloman, facing this drought, don't have that kind of support. And what they do have at hand to adapt with is cheap weaponry. And the area is flooded with AK-47s that are the result of the leftovers of the Cold War, when the Horn of Africa was a front line in the proxy fights between the USSR and the U.S. And in particular, Somalia and Ethiopia fought a very bloody war for 10 years with the Cubans and the Russians or Soviets supporting Ethiopia, and the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan supporting Somalia. And that ended with the collapse of Somalia as a state. And so now the region is awash in cheap weapons flowing out of Somalia, but also, you know, out of the Ugandan armories were looted, and there was war for a long time in South Sudan. So the leftovers of the Cold War means that people like Ekuru Aloman have access to cheap weaponry. They don't have alternative livelihood supports from the state. They're facing this drought. So the means of adaptation are picking up the gun, stealing your neighbor's cattle, and fighting over the few water holes that are that exist. And so in that combination of things, which I call the catastrophic convergence, climate change did play a role in how Ekuru Aloman was killed. But it's climate change in combination with these pre-existing crises. And that's always the way climate change plays out, is by amplifying pre-existing problems.
Why is it that developing countries, when these problems crop up, in many cases seem more likely to respond to problems with violence and with political repression rather than policy solutions to what ails them?
Well, part of it is the embrace of radical free market economics that has been a requirement for countries that are in debt. And so many developing economies in the global south incurred a lot of debt, sometimes well spent on actually developing projects, sometimes wasted and these loans were then stolen by, and that was sort of the case in Kenya, where Daniel Arap Moi was a legendarily corrupt leader who managed to abscond with over $1 billion worth of public money. But then the country had to pay off those loans, and to get more loans, took more loans to pay off the old loans, and with those came these stipulations, these structural adjustment plans from the World Bank and IMF, and those, you know, require that the state kind of withdraw. And so that means that states don't really have the capacity to respond properly. And the one aspect of government that has remained legitimate and continues to receive support is the repressive function, policing and military. And, you know, those are the arms of of government in the Global South that continue to receive support now under the framework of the War on Terror, but, you know, for many, many years under the, you know, as part of the Cold War. So that's one reason why governments in the Global South don't respond more creatively.
Well, Christian, to the extent that international monetary policy is culpable, at least in some way, for some of the devastation that we're seeing, are there people in those organizations, in the IMF and in the World Bank, saying it's time to rethink the way we structure monetary policy?
There is. There's to some extent, a rethink of radical free market economics because of the last financial crash. But, you know, generally, that is still, unfortunately, that is still the prevailing mode, is that the government should be reduced, as Grover Norquist put it, to a size where it can be drowned in the bathtub. I mean, that's essentially the theory that we see guiding the Greek bailout. You know, they want to privatize everything. And now, I mean, that's not a third-world developing economy. That's part of the European core. But, yeah, unfortunately, there has not really been a massive rethink among financial leaders about the role of the government within capitalist development. So that remains to be done. There, in certain countries in the Global South, that's being rethought, like Brazil has definitely moved back towards, you know, a Keynesian style of economic management, and has tried to boost internal demand and therefore internal development, industrialization, and shore up Brazilian businesses by making sure that Brazilian consumers have jobs and decent wages and stuff like that. So there's been a lot of redistribution of wealth in Brazil that has had the effect of really helping the capitalist class in having high growth rates and decent return on their investment and stuff like that. So at the national level, you see a rethink going on, but internationally, not really.
Is there a relationship between climate change and the rise of religious and tribal extremism?
Well, in that people respond, in that climate change creates anxiety and desperation, then people turn to whatever stories are at hand for explaining the crisis. So you definitely see people turning to ethnic and religious things. So, I mean, an example I use in the book is Kyrgyzstan. In Kyrgyzstan, about a year and a half ago, people might remember there was a violence broke out between Uzbeks and Kyrgyz, and the capital, Bishkek, went up in flames. One government fell, another government came in. They requested intervention by Russian troops. The Russians wisely declined. Underneath that violence between Uzbeks and Kyrgyz is this story. The country, Kyrgyzstan, depends for 90% of its electricity on hydroelectric power, particularly from one massive old Soviet dam. There's been a drought that has been punishing Central Asia, for including Afghanistan, for 10 years.
So no water, no power, essentially.
No water, no power. So they started rationing power. That meant that industry had to start laying people off because it couldn't operate all the time. And then came a freakishly cold winter, increased demand for power. Then they tried to privatize the power company. Then people hit the streets protesting these economic issues, and then that devolved into ethnic clashes. So beneath the ethnic clashes, an economic crisis, beneath the economic crisis, an environmental crisis of drought and then a freak winter.
Christian Parenti is my guest. He's a contributing editor at The Nation and visiting scholar at City University of New York. We're talking about his new book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Join the conversation in a moment by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Christian Parenti. He is contributing editor at The Nation and visiting scholar at City University of New York. His new book is called Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk a little bit more about the situation in Pakistan. You write about Pakistan having suffered terribly from first years of drought, and then there was a devastating flood last year, and now there's flooding once again. 10 million people driven from their homes. And even before this all happened, these agriculture workers were living essentially like feudal serfs.
Yeah, that was actually not in the book, but in an article I did recently for the Nation. I went to Pakistan to look at the effects of the flood 1 year on. And one thing that I found, surprisingly, was that there were people who had been displaced but did not want to return to the land, and it was because conditions for the Hadi, the landless tenant farmers, are so bad in some areas that they would prefer to live in refugee camps, particularly when those camps were near cities and they had access to education, potentially, mm-hmm. which there is no access to education for many of them in the countryside. And they had access to wage labor, and they were beginning to transform themselves from landless, indebted peasant farmers to urban workers. And with that transition came considerable freedom, because the landlord class in Pakistan, I mean, this is something that Americans should really be thinking about. I mean, we've spent $20 billion fighting terrorism in Pakistan, a state where the intelligence services have repeatedly been linked to terrorist forces. And we have done nothing to encourage land reform. And the landlord class in Pakistan, they frequently will operate private jails. They don't allow teachers in the schools. They sell the peasants who work on their land, who rent their land. They sell them the seed and fertilizer. The peasants fall into debt. They can never work their way out of this. And this is a source of a lot of anger, and it's part of what is already destabilizing Pakistan, a country with atomic weapons and multiple armed insurgencies. And we have poured military support into the country for 20 years, and very little stability has come from that. I mean, Pakistan has become less and less stable. And one cause of it is this horrendous class inequality in the countryside. There's never really been any land reform, and the vast majority of agricultural workers in Pakistan have no rights. And so that leads to rage and frustration that can easily be harnessed by radical fundamentalist movements, of which there are plenty in Pakistan.
And on an individual basis, it would make sense that some of these workers and some of these families might indeed be better off as wage laborers in cities. But of course, as in many parts of the world, and particularly in this Tropic of Chaos that you describe, there's a huge amount of tension in urban centers that are suddenly being inundated by people who can no longer make a living off the land.
That's right. And the people in Pakistan, you know, they're trying to get rid of these refugee camps frequently. The landlords are pressuring the police to send them back, and so there's already been violence. But yeah, there can be ethnic violence, and in Pakistan, it's political violence, and to some extent ethnically driven, but political violence in Karachi these days between two parties, the MQM and the PPP, and running gun battles. But other examples from that region of how climate change can breed instability is, I think, Afghanistan. It's something for people to think about. One, when I was in Afghanistan doing research on the heroin economy is when I first began thinking of this book, because the farmers would frequently explain why they were involved in growing opium poppy in terms of it being drought-resistant. And at the time, I didn't really realize there was a drought. Turns out Afghanistan has been in the worst drought in living memory for the whole period of the NATO nation-building project there. Hmm. And poppy uses one-fifth the amount of water that wheat uses. And in this war, the Afghan government and the NATO forces attack poppy and try to eradicate it, and the Taliban defends poppy. So one little contributing factor to why there are so many young men willing to fight for the Taliban is the fact that the Taliban are the side in the conflict that protects their family's right to grow the only crop that, given the drought, is economically feasible. It uses one-fifth the amount of water of wheat. So when NATO and the Afghan government are coming along saying, hey, look, you have to go back to growing apricots and raisins and wheat, it's simply not feasible because of the drought. So there's a way in which climate change, as expressed through this drought, is helping to exacerbate the conflict and helps explain why it drags on and on.
So would we be better off with irrigation involvement over there, or presenting them with technologies that allow them to grow legitimate crops that are drought resistant?
You know, there have to be specific strategies of adaptation to specific places, and they're best developed by the people in those conditions and situations.
Uh-huh.
So I'm very hesitant to offer a program of solutions. I mean, but Afghanistan, I mean, I think realistically, a path towards stability would actually involve embracing the poppy economy and finding some way to utilize that crop in the world medical system. And there's actually a pretty reputable foundation, the Sinless Foundation out of the UK, put forward a plan to do that. And they made the point that the world is, in fact, full of people who are dying of chronic illnesses who need painkillers. And could there not be a way to legally buy much of this crop and turn it into morphine and supply it cheaply to people in other parts of the global south who currently go without painkillers to deal with their diseases? I mean, that's one idea specific to Afghanistan, but Afghanistan is such a deeply flawed place and project that it'd be very, very hard at this point, I think, to really introduce much stability there. Unless, of course, the Taliban want to come to the table and talk, which they flirt with doing, and then interrupt the process by attacking hotels and killing Karzai's family members and close advisors. So the situation there looks very, very bad. But one thing I can say more broadly in response to your question is we have to start thinking about how climate change fits into all of these different situations around the world, and what the specific responses on the ground are will be different. But there should be an acknowledgement of the fact that climate change is part of the security equation. That doesn't necessarily mean there should be military response. And there was, in fact, last week the UN Security Council debated this question. They said, should we include climate change as one of the factors we look at and respond to? And there was tremendous pushback from members of the General Assembly that were saying, well, look, you know, the UN is already dealing with climate change. We have these negotiations going on to come up with a successor agreement to the Kyoto Protocol. We don't think climate change should be militarized. Yes, it does engender security issues. It does cause instability, but that does not necessarily mean that military response is the correct response. Really, what there has to be is new forms of adaptation, which is, you know, economic development that is appropriate to the changing climate and the extreme weather. And there has to be mitigation. That is, we have to reduce carbon emissions drastically. And the science on this is very clear, that we have to reduce emissions starting now and get them down by 80% over the next 20 to 30 years. Or there are very potentially tipping points in the climate system. I mean, this is something climate science has just really gotten a handle on in the last two decades, ever since the ice cores were extracted from Greenland, which only first happened in the mid-1990s. They were able to analyze year by year, basically 10,000 years of climate history, and what they discovered was that climate changes, but it doesn't change gradually as we had thought. It frequently changes rather suddenly. So the risk is that we keep burning fossil fuel, oil and coal, and there is so much CO2 and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that there could be an abrupt and sudden shift in global climate and a real acceleration in the rate of change. And so that's why it's so imperative that we cut emissions as soon as possible, as fast as possible, because it's not necessarily going to be that easy to respond later if abrupt climate change kicks in. And the other thing that happens is that there are positive feedback loops which have negative consequences in this whole process. For example, if the permafrost is melting in the Arctic, beneath the permafrost are huge stores of methane, natural methane, that is a greenhouse gas 20 times more powerful than CO2. If the permafrost melts completely and all of that methane escapes, that will accelerate global warming radically and in a way that civilization can't really control and respond to. And right now, we're the main cause of putting greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, so we can control that, we can stop it, we should do it now before these self-fueling processes kick off, such as the release of methane, the total disappearance of ice in the north, which means that more light from the sun and more heat is absorbed because black, you know, open water is dark and absorbs more heat. Ice is white and reflects a lot of heat back into space. So if we have ice-free poles, then that is going to accelerate climate change radically all on its own.
Christian Parenti is my guest. His new book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Gina on the line in Garland. Hello, Gina.
Hi. Fascinating conversation. I have a question for the author. Can you tell us about any specific organizations that are working on land reform, and or is there any hope of initiating a negative feedback loop on the process that you were just talking about to sustain where we are now, to give us more time to correct, get the emissions down and all of that? And I'd love to take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
In reverse order, the only thing that can be done with carbon emissions is to reduce them. There's this, experimental technology of stripping CO2 out of the atmosphere and sequestering it, but that is very, very experimental, expensive, not online, not an antidote to burning coal and oil. We get 50% of our electricity from coal. So we need to really just reduce emissions. And we could, if we were serious about that, we could get on it right away. One thing that could happen is most coal plants in the United States could be switched over to natural gas without very much retrofitting at all. That alone would reduce our total greenhouse gas emissions by 13%. Now, natural gas is a fuel with problems associated with fracking, but that's not the only way it is taken from the earth. It also comes up with oil, as people in Texas know well. But, that's something that could happen with almost zero retrofitting. The problem is storing the natural gas at the coal plants is more expensive than storing coal, so utilities are hesitant to do this. But there has to be massive investment, ultimately, in wind and solar power and hydroelectric and tidal kinetics, and all of that renewable energy needs to be developed. And other countries are doing that. It's happening here a little bit, but not as fast as it should. And in the end of the book, I actually offered a couple of concrete suggestions on how we could move forward with mitigation. One is through government purchasing. The U.S., the federal government and state governments together constitute over a third of U.S. GDP. If the federal government committed itself to buying clean power, that would be good in of itself. It would reduce carbon emissions, but it would also create economies of scale that would allow the burgeoning clean tech sector to lower the costs of their products, their energy and electric vehicles, et cetera. And once the price for clean technology is competitive with dirty technology, then the private sector will embrace it for economic reasons. So that's something that can happen without lining up, 60 votes in the Senate, without appropriating new money, without, any of that rigmarole, which has been so fruitless in recent years, particularly on the climate front in D.C. So there's some very meaningful activities that can be done. And the federal government is the largest single consumer of energy in the U.S. It has the largest fleet of buildings in the U.S. It has the largest fleet of vehicles. So it and is going to spend money on electricity for these buildings. It is going to buy replacement vehicles for the General Services Agency, for the post office, et cetera, et cetera. So there's actually a lot of money that's going to be spent anyway that can be used to help jumpstart clean tech. And the Obama administration, to its credit, did issue an executive order encouraging or ordering federal agencies to begin studying the feasibility of this and come up with plans, but then there have been delays and there's been considerable pushback from the GOP about this, so that transition of the federal government's environmental footprint has sort of stalled out. The other thing that could happen right now without passing new legislation is for the EPA to really regulate greenhouse gas emissions robustly. And that's why the right in this country has attacked the EPA so viciously, is because the EPA, since 2007, has been charged with the responsibility of cleaning up greenhouse gas emissions. Environmentalists sued beginning in the late 1990s to try and say, hey, look, the Clean Air Act of 1970 says if there's some sort of pollution that's harmful to human health, it's the EPA's job to regulate and clean it up. And they said greenhouse gas emissions like CO2 from burning coal harm human health, therefore they should be covered under the Clean Air Act. 10 years later, the Supreme Court said that is true. The EPA has the responsibility to regulate these greenhouse gas emissions. The Bush administration ignored that ruling and did nothing about it. The Obama administration has begun to allow the EPA to follow the law, but there are about 30 specific rules pertaining to greenhouse gases that the EPA has been waiting to issue, and they've been dragging their feet, and the few rules they have issued have been very tepid and not robust enough. If the EPA were aggressive in how it regulated greenhouse gas emissions, that would essentially raise the cost of carbon, and the more expensive it is to burn coal and oil, the more profitable it is to sell the alternatives, wind and solar power.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. Christian Parenti is with us. His new book is called Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Christian Parenti. He is a contributing editor at The Nation and a visiting scholar at City University of New York. His new book is called Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Christian, I want to switch gears here, at least for a little while, and touch on an argument in the book that you make that I think is very interesting. And that is, you acknowledge that the U.S. government, and particularly the Pentagon, has recognized the security threat to the growing global instability caused by climate change in this place you define as the Tropic of Chaos. But you worry that the counterinsurgency strategies being developed as a response, potentially, could make things worse for innocent people in the hardest hit places. Can you talk about that?
Yes. The Pentagon, to its credit, takes the science of climate change very seriously, and they've run projections that are some of which are public and available online. And what they see in the future is not so much an increase in conventional wars between states as a result of climate change, but more an increase in state breakdown, state failure, religious warfare, insurgency, ethnic insurgency, intercommunal conflict between ethnic groups and religious groups, mass migration, increased banditry, and they realize they're going to be called upon to respond to these crises, and that response is going to take the form of counterinsurgency, low-intensity conflict, counterterror responses, rather than conventional responses of force-on-force combat. And also to their credit, most of these reports end by calling for mitigation. They say, you know, there could be a military response up to a point to manage this chaos. But ultimately, if we hit all the climatological tipping points and just burn all the coal and all the oil, the situation will get so bad that there cannot be any kind of military response. But the problem with counterinsurgency is that because it takes the civilian society as its object, it's not about controlling territory, winning territory from another army. The government forces in a counterinsurgency generally already control the territory. What they don't control is the population. So it's a fight for the loyalty and the obedience of the population, the hearts and minds. And that involves techniques that attack the social fabric of a society. And counterinsurgency is generally, you know, in response to rebellions, either sort of traditionalist rebellions of people not wanting to change their way of life, or revolutionary rebellions, people wanting to have a communist or socialist revolution, or a nationalist ethnic revolution, or a religious revolution. And so there's this focus also from the insurgents on the social fabric, on changing the rules of daily life and the habits of people. And so too, counterinsurgency works in the same way. You get dislocation of people, you know, removing villages, rebuilding them, reconstituting them so the army and the police can control them. The tactics of counterinsurgency typically involve, you know, torture, interrogation, assassination, smuggling, and the development of auxiliaries, civilian paramilitaries to support the government forces. And what the effect of all this is after the war is that the society is left with its social fabric ripped to pieces, the landscape littered with guns, and frequently, you know, there are bands of armed men trained in the arts of assassination, torture, extortion, smuggling, and the great cause of the battle might be gone, but these armed groups and their weaponry and tactics remain and are very, very destabilizing. So, I mean, you can see that in Central America, which was the front lines of counterinsurgency throughout the late 70s, 80s, into the early 90s. And now in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Honduras, the murder rate in those countries is so high that it frequently rivals the death toll during the worst years of the war. But there's no two sides to the conflict. There's no cause. There's no war. There's just lots of killing. There's cheap weapons and traumatized people and lots of men who spent years being trained in how to kill and intimidate and torture. So counterinsurgency is very destabilizing, ultimately, for a society. And therefore, I think it's dangerous for that to be the primary response or the primary form of adaptation, because it's going to make societies in the global south less resilient, less capable of adapting to climate change and mitigating, that is to say, reducing their emissions. So, I mean, I wouldn't expect the Pentagon really to do anything different. They don't make policy, they implement policy. You know, the military does what the military is designed to do. But my point is that we can't leave this to the military. That's not an appropriate set of institutions to be the primary response to climate change.
We have an email here from Julian who writes, I read recently that for what the U.S. spent on unsuccessful opium eradication policies, we could have bought the entire crop, I'm assuming he means in Afghanistan, every year since 2001. Is this true? Do you know anything about that?
I don't actually know the total numbers on the eradication budget. So, I mean, we've spent a lot of money in Afghanistan, that's for sure. And as I mentioned earlier, there was this serious proposal floated by the Sinless Foundation that there should be a concerted effort to do exactly what the caller suggested, buy up the opium crop and process it into morphine to be provided on the global market, you know, to people who are dying of HIV and tuberculosis and, you know, all these horrible terminal diseases, cancer. And in many countries, people, you know, cannot afford painkillers. So there is a market and there is a supply, but that's, you know, nobody is thinking in those terms around opium eradication. And the reality is that there's so much corruption in Afghanistan. The Afghan government is so thoroughly corrupt that there's very little opium eradication done. I mean, usually what happens is the eradication teams go in and they threaten the farmers, they shake them down. The farmers have to pay them really expensive bribes. And then, you know, one or two fields get knocked down in front of the cameras, and so they can then claim that they've eradicated opium. But it's really basically like much of the rest of the Afghan government, just a big racket for stealing money from the common people.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Aram on the line in Grapevine. Hi, Aram.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guest has looked at the total energy cycle for going green. For instance, some time back we had this discussion about having ethanol, but when you look at the total energy required to get 1 gallon of ethanol, it's not better, actually, it's worse than getting 1 gallon of gas. So in that context, has your guest looked at the other means of going green, you know, electric cars, solar panels, and whatnot? And if so, if you could share that with us. Thank you.
Yeah, I have not looked at the energy budget required for establishing clean technology. I mean, most of the book deals with these questions of economic development and political instability and violence. Obviously, it would require, I mean, building windmills in an economy that does not run on wind power involves a considerable carbon footprint.
Mm-hmm.
The exact numbers of that, I don't know, but the transition to clean tech sector definitely involves burning fossil fuels. The caller is completely correct about ethanol. I mean, ethanol is really not a clean or green source of energy, and as I'm sure many of the listeners are aware, I mean, that's about swing states and votes in swing farm states, and nobody in Congress is brave enough to risk those, you know, swing voters in swing states, and so there are these massive programs of essentially subsidies to the corn belt, and it's done in the name of clean energy, but it is not clean at all, and does not reduce the carbon footprint.
Does the presence of robust democracy provide a sort of guarantee against violence in the face of climate change?
Possibly. I mean, I don't really look at things so formulaically with, like, sets of rules that can be applied. I mean, it's really, the book is a series of case studies. And I mean, the reason geography is in the title is because I believe that there is a kind of, you know, a geographic specificity is required in every kind of response. And so there are examples of robust democracy helping. I mean, in Brazil, I look at the case of the landless peasant movement there, and it's called the MST, Movimento Sem Terra, and they've been very successful over the last 20 years of using direct action, occupying unused land, and then getting title to it. And they have helped tens of thousands of landless peasants get land and become productive. And in the northeast of Brazil, which is a semi-arid region, which has always been a hard place to survive and is now getting battered by climate change, increased freak flooding, but mostly drought, serious drought. I found an MST community up there that was adopting what they called the system, or agroecological forestry. It involved basically using tree crops with vine crops, just mixing various crops together to trap moisture in the land. They also had all these interesting techniques of water harvesting, like building underground dams. So they would basically take like a wash or an arroyo where there's, you know, some moisture would drain out of a hill, and build basically a dam in the earth. So dig down to bedrock, say 10 feet, then build a wall like a dam, and then fill it back in. So there's not water on the upstream side of the dam. There's just earth, but it blocks the moisture and in that terrain, and then they would farm on that. So all those interesting techniques for adapting to a more severe climate. And they were doing this on one side of the road where they owned the land. On the other side of the road, they didn't own the land. They were occupying an absentee cattle ranch, Italian cattle rancher's land. And there they were using the same old traditional techniques or modern techniques of monocropping, using pesticides and artificial fertilizers. And they explained that, you know, they had to do that because it would guarantee them some income in the short term. And until they owned the land, they couldn't really take care of the land. And to my mind, that was a perfect example of how social justice is necessary for there to be technological adaptation. So in terms of robust democracy, you know, there's an example of kind of a democratic movement providing people with land titles, redistributing land in Brazil, which is a highly unequal society, and that being the basis for good stewardship of the land. So in that place, in that example, I'd say, yes, definitely, you're right. The robust democracy does facilitate better adaptation and mitigation of the climate crisis.
Talk about the response that has existed from developed countries to the flood of immigration and migration into those countries by people looking for work. You end the book with a story near the end about a one-time fisherman in Michoacan who ends up moving to Juarez, which we know in this part of the country has had terrible problems. But he goes looking for work, and eventually he wants to work in El Paso.
Yes, he had actually been a roofer in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and he had been deported. But he was a climate refugee, essentially, and he was sitting there on the north bank of the Rio Grande saying, you know, I want to get back into the U.S. I need money for a coyote to take me in. The only thing I think I can do here is get involved in the drug trade, and I really don't want to do that. And he had been a fisherman who had been forced to move because an El Nino event in the late 90s caused warm water to move up past where in Michoacan, and there was an algae bloom, toxic algae bloom, that drove the fish away. He went into debt to deal with that bad year. He couldn't pay the debt. He lost his boat. Then he migrated north. So climate change pressed through bad economic policies that don't support poor small fishermen, pushed him north. And then in the U.S., on the U.S. side of the border, what we see is border militarization. Now, border militarization is not caused by climate change. The border militarization really began in the 1990s. But increasingly, the discourse of this kind of xenophobic anti-immigrant element of the U.S. right is articulating its agenda in environmental terms, that there's an environmental crisis, there's not enough to go around, so we need to sacrifice our civil liberties, and immigrants need to be rounded up and deported, and the border needs to be militarized. And, you know, in places like Phoenix, where people are acutely aware of the fact that they have to pump in water and that's not particularly feasible, this is an aspect in the discussion.
Christian Parenti, I'm so sorry we're out of time, Christian. Christian Parenti is a contributing editor at The Nation and a visiting scholar at City University of New York. His new book is called Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Christian, it's been a very interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you very much for having me on. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.